Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link. All right. From The Guardian. Congratulations, those in London or going to London, because you now have an opportunity to visit the Warburg Institute. This has long been off limits to passersby, but it has now been reborn after a £14.5 million transformation with a mission to be more public than ever. Are any of you familiar with the Warburg Institute?
No, I've never heard of it.
It's basically an occult library.
Oh.
And according to Bill Sherman, the director of the Warburg, quote, "We are essentially devoted to the study of what you would now call memes."
I don't know that he knows what a meme is, in fact.
Well, let me put it back to you. I mean, our current iteration of memes are, you know, lolcats or doges, but taking from like a very semiotic lens, which is just, you know, the study of symbolism, what this is a collection of repeating motifs and archetypes and images that have been categorized in the most unique way. So if you are an information architect geek, this one's going to be for you too. So you have a collection here that ranges from books on Islamic astronomy to tomes on comets and divination. We've got original paintings used for tarot cards. And here's what really lit a flame of bibliophilia within me. At least half of the books cannot be found in any other library in the country.
Wow.
Oh, yes. Now, the Institute was founded by pioneering German art historian A.B. Warburg, whose work focused on tracing the roots of the Renaissance and ancient civilizations, and then mapping out how images are transmitted across time and space. Which sounds kind of pedestrian in our post-internet world, but pre-internet, what an undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
He was drawing unlikely connections between different epochs, regions, different media types, and he put his findings in a sprawling visual diagram of European art. They call this the Bilderatlas Nemesine. Kind of like an old school Pinterest board, basically.
Yeah, or like a crime scene board where you're like the red
thread
connects all these.
But very, very organized. Very organized. Unsurprisingly, this undertaking was so huge, it was incomplete by the time of his death in 1929. Now, Warburg hailed from a wealthy Jewish banking family. So when most of the Nazis came to power in the 1930s, the whole institute, the staff, and most of the furniture, they had to evacuate, is the word used, to Britain. 60,000 books and 10,000 photographs became part of the University of London, housed in a building designed by Charles Holden in the 1950s, where it had been ever since. But it had never had much of a public face. It was basically an essential resource for artists and scholars, but few outside the rarefied ranks of researchers even knew that this institute was there. Elizabeth Flower of Haworth Tompkins, architect of the institute overhaul, she even says, "I cycled past this building for years without knowing what was inside," which for an occult library, that's pretty on brand, let's be honest. But what they did was make upgrades to heating, lighting, energy performance. Now, the project has given the Institute a public museum-grade gallery for the first time, plus a new auditorium. They've done a lot of windows to let in light, but of course they've added UV films because this is a library of rare things. But what they were able to do with this expansion was reinstate this unique catalog system. They have four floors dedicated to image, word, orientation, and action. This was sort of the praxis that united the various branches of the history of human civilization. That's what close collaborator Fritz Saxel said. And there are a few other libraries in the world where you might open a drawer of photographs, it says gestures. And within, what are the subfolders? Okay, you've got fleeing, flying, grasping the victim's head, garment raised to eyes, parentheses, grief. Now, this unusual system might not have caught on elsewhere, but it does provide a really powerful and unique way for artists, writers, researchers to make unexpected connections and pursue fertile tangents of swiping through hashtags.
I was going to say, yeah, it's kind of hashtaggy. Mm-hmm.
It is very hashtaggy, right? You're organizing it by a facet to give the opportunity to approach it from a different direction or connect it to something else. And if any of you are familiar with novelist Naomi Alderman, I think she wrote The Power. She wrote that it's a building filled with literal magic. One brief stroll through the shelves and I always find some new weird inspiration.
Question I have is, do they provide the virgin sacrifice or do I?
Right. That's part of it.
I think they take the blood oath before you enter just for liability purposes.
Okay. But, you know, they'll always take donations. Like, it's a museum. They're like...
All right. Next link. Next link.
This article comes to us from CNN, and it's titled, Sea Robins Are Fish with the Wings of a Bird and Multiple Legs Like a Crab.
What?
I'm sorry, they decided to call this creature a sea robin?
Yeah, it's really more kind of like a freaky catfish.
Okay.
I've never heard about this animal before, never seen it. This article has quite a few clips and images, and they are really, really freaky looking. So, some types of sea robins, a peculiar bottom-dwelling ocean fish, use taste bud-covered legs to sense and dig up prey along the seafloor, according to new research. Huh. They're so adept at rooting out prey as they walk along the ocean floor on their six leg-like appendages that other fish follow them around in the hope of snagging some freshly uncovered prey themselves.
He's like the Pied Piper of the ocean floor.
Yeah. Like, really, if you look at this thing from the top down, it really does look like a fish, but then you add two really big fins that the way it holds them almost looks like a manta ray or something like that.
Yeah.
And then attached to those same fins are the six leg appendage things, which are not technically legs, actually part of the fins. And then the fish itself is just like kind of derpy looking, like honestly, very just like, ooh, I'm here. Yeah.
It's like we blew the budget on all the other appendages. We got to let this one go.
Exactly. So David Kingsley, co-author of both studies, first came across the fish in the summer of 2016 after giving a seminar at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Kingsley said in an email, I've never seen a fish that looked like it was made of body parts from many different types of animals. So it's basically like the platypus of the SeaWorld, I guess.
Right, yeah.
So Kingsley and his colleagues decided to study sea robins in a lab setting, uncovering a wealth of surprises, including the difference between sea robin species and the genetics responsible for their unusual traits, such as leg-like fins that have evolved so they largely function as sensory organs. Other fish species have modifications to their pectoral or pelvic fins that allow them to walk or perch, but sea robins can move their legs individually, which makes them more adept at walking and digging. The team observed the fish alternating between short bouts of swimming and walking, and they're also seen scratching at the sandy surface covering the bottoms of the tanks without any visual cues to let them know where prey might be buried. To continue their research, the study authors had more sea robins shipped to the lab, only to discover that they represented an entirely different species with varying traits.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not just one freaky sea robin, like there's a bunch of types of them. And the two sample groups of sea robins looked the same, but the newly delivered fish didn't dig or find buried prey. The digging sea robins had shovel-shaped legs that were covered in protrusions called papillae, which are similar to the taste buds on our tongues. But the non-digging sea robins had rod-shaped legs without any papillae. As the scientists studied the fish on a genetic level and compared how their legs have developed over time, they realized that species that dig are only found in a few locations, such as the sandy shallow waters of New England, which suggests the fish only recently evolved this trait.
Hmm.
We think that the digging and non-digging species are separated by around 10 million to 20 million years, which means that the papillae would have had to emerge sometime after that.
Hmm.
The study authors' research revealed that digging sea robins depend on a regulatory gene called TBX3A, not only to develop their specialized fin adaptations, but also to form the papillae that cause them to dig. That same gene also plays a role in limb development in humans, mice, chickens, and other fish species, according to the study authors. This is a fish that grew legs using the same genes that contribute to the development of our limbs, and then repurposed these legs to find prey using the same genes our tongues use to taste food. Which is kind of weird. Like, I would not think that, oh, you just take that gene over to the fin, and then there you go. Mm-hmm. You got a leg-like thing.
Mm-hmm. But... yeah, just recombine it as needed, man. Yeah. Pick and choose.
This sounds a lot like Dr. Zoidberg's origin story.
There you go.
Yeah, it sounds like they're also evolving into crabs.
Yeah, like crab everything,
evolution?
You know.
Yeah, let's say kaiju. These are baby kaiju. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We'll just give them a little more time.
Yeah, we'll see them in the next 10 million, assuming they're still around. I mean, we won't. They will.
Right.
Next link?
Next link.
All right, this comes from the BBC. Postcards are the emails of their day. How cat memes went viral 100 years ago. Ben Weiss, a senior curator at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts and co-curator of the museum's The Postcard Age exhibit, says some things persist across generations and media. The depictions of cats are one of those things. In the 19th and 20th century, Weiss says postcards functioned like social media today. It was cheaper, faster, more convenient than a letter. Postcards were used to share random musings, plan logistics for where they wanted to meet, tell jokes, and, as always, post cat pictures. The first postcards were printed in Austria-Hungary in 1869. Fortuitous timing for an innovation because in 1874, 21 countries established the Universal Postal Union. Mm-hmm. So, like memes, postcards carried not just a picture, but were tangible evidence of the vast network and powerful institutions that had transported them rapidly across either far distance or short distance. Apparently, during the early days of postcards, people were sending them like we send emails now. You could send a postcard to somebody at 10 saying you'd be there by 5:30 if you're going to go from like Manhattan to Jersey City, and the message would get there.
Huh.
So between 1900 and 1914, Weiss says there's this massive worldwide postcard craze to the point where people talk about it being a disease in the public bloodstream.
Whoa.
At the time, cats were considered more than just pest control. So they were starting to make their way into the house. Monarchs and socialites, including Queen Victoria, were famous cat enjoyers. And the animals association with Halloween was already well established. Some postcards just featured cats being cats, sipping milk from saucers, playing with yarn. But others dressed cats up as humans, working jobs, and taking part in domestic scenes.
Yay!
But of course, not everyone was comfortable with the postcard's impact on society. Newspapers called it a, quote, fresh terror and a Frankenstein's monster, alarmed by the product's popularity. The sacks of postal workers swelling with postcards, leading to stories about injuries from lifting overflowing mailbags.
Incidences of paper cuts, balloon. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And there were lots of complaints about what postcards were going to do to people's reading and writing skills. Because, I mean, if you just dash a few lines, why would you need to actually learn grammar and become a good writer? This stuff all sounds familiar, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But at the end of the day, whether we like it or not, new forms of social media will bring new forms of cat. And like some memes today, postcard culture intersected with politics. This is where I think it's neat. Some of the most famous postcard cats are associated with the suffrage movement.
Yeah! Heck yeah!
Right, because cats were typically associated with household settings and, right, quote, meant to be passive, beautiful, decorative, and demure. But at the same time, cats are predators, and anyone who owns a cat will tell you. So the movement was savvy in the use of the new media like postcards and film to get their message out, and cats offered a potent symbolism. Suffragettes successfully waged a decades-long campaign to persuade an all-male electorate and to show that new media was crucial in part of their success. So, J.D. Vance, the cat lady vote is not one you want to belittle. It has a powerful historical precedent in this nation.
Yeah. I mean, listen, if what I'm sending on social media was originally a postcard, but it's still an adorable picture, I'm going to send it. That sounds awesome.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. Next up, we've got one from publicdomainreview.org called A Very Tall Tale, Photograph of the Cardiff Giant. Hmm. So first question, are any of y'all familiar with the Cardiff Giant?
The guy with the big thing in the place.
Nope.
No, that's a different one.
No, yeah, that's somebody else.
This is like fake bones.
Kind of. So I wasn't familiar with it. This article was acting like it was a pretty well-known historical event. I thought maybe it was just me. So the short version is that the Cardiff Giant was a hoax perpetrated in the late 1800s. And it was, of course, claiming to be evidence of a literal race of giants. So it all started with a man named George Hull, who was, by all accounts, not just a liar and a con man, but a pretty horrible person. One neighbor said he had eyes that, quote, would pry and gimlet and corkscrew clear down into the innermost recesses of our souls.
Yikes.
Wow.
So, you know, popular among his friends and family. He made a living at various times as a horse trader, a card cheat, and a failed tobacco tycoon. And while most of his contemporaries agreed that he was illiterate, Hull always insisted that he was a voracious reader of philosopher David Hume. When Hull was in his 30s, he married his 16-year-old niece. And while he enjoyed arguing with anyone, he really liked arguing with men of faith. In particular, one night in 1867, he got into a fight with a Methodist minister about giants in the Bible, who are mentioned and described in several different contexts. So the minister was like, yeah, they're real. And Hull thought this was just ridiculous, saying, quote, I lay wide awake that night wondering why people would believe those stories. Now, at this same time, America was going a little nuts on the idea of human petrification, which is exactly what it sounds like, in the same way that wood can become petrified when its organic matter is slowly replaced with minerals. The same can happen, though it is rare, with a human corpse.
Whoa.
And there are tons of news stories from the 1800s, some of which might even be true, about grave sites being exhumed for one reason or another, only for their loved ones to discover that the bodies had been turned to stone. So Hull put two and two together and realized that all he needed was a giant statue, and people would happily believe that it was the petrified corpse of a real giant. Also, he got a little geographically lucky, because in the area surrounding Cardiff, New York, where he lived, there was a group of native people called the Onondaga who told stories of ancient stone giants who had conquered their homelands and ancestors. So he's got this plan. He's got a local myth to back it up. All he needs is a statue. But he knew he couldn't just go to the local quarry and buy a 10-foot block of stone without somebody noticing. So first, he traveled to Iowa to get the stone. Then he paid to have it dragged by horses and oxen even further west to Montana, as if that were its final destination. Then he doubled back and sent the stone by train to Chicago, where two marble cutters, who were presumably in on the deal, began sculpting it based on Hull's own nude body. Because you got to use somebody. And he's like, I'm the perfect specimen.
Can't ask anybody. The secret stays safe.
Exactly. But he was precise about the details. The original carving they did featured curly hair, just like Hull. But he met with a local geographer and confirmed that hair didn't fossilize, so they chiseled that bit off. Then they poured ink and sulfuric acid over the stone to give it a more aged appearance. Finally, Hull shipped the completed statue back to Cardiff in secret and buried it on the farm of a man named Stubb Newell, who was definitely related to Hull somehow, but it's not super clear how, partly because, you know, he married his own niece, so the family tree's a little tangled there.
Wow.
Newell then very innocently hired two men to dig a well on his property, and lo and behold, they found the body of the Cardiff Giant. And almost immediately, the hoax was exposed, starting with the fact that the body was supposed to be Onondagan, but was definitely a white guy, and also there was no legitimate reason to dig a well where Newell had claimed that he wanted one. But it didn't even matter, because people wanted to believe so badly. Within just the first few hours after digging it up, locals had already paid the modern equivalent of $4,000 just to get a look at it, and Hull quickly arranged to send the statue on the road as a traveling exhibit. It became so famous that legendary circus founder P.T. Barnum tried to buy the statue several times, but when the owners wouldn't sell, Barnum simply had a copy made out of plaster and began claiming that his was the original and Hull's was the fake.
Your fake is a fake.
Merge exactly.
You're the puppet.
Yeah. Well, and you know P.T. Barnum had to realize, obviously, this guy just faked this thing. Why can't I? Like, I could do the same thing.
There's it takes money to know one. He just faked it wrong.
Exactly. And while there's no certain proof, some historians do believe that Barnum's famous line, there's a sucker born every minute, was said in reference to the Cardiff Giant specifically.
Woof.
Now, eventually, the Cardiff Giant's popularity did die down, and it spent many of its later years in the front yard of Calvin O. Gott, who was the photographer hired to take pictures of the statue as it came out of the ground. And it's hard to say even now who was a genuine believer and who was just happy to take the money. But anyone who knew Hull in person had to realize the thing looked exactly like him. So I think Gott at least had to know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of it. They don't say where it ended up. Maybe it's been destroyed. I'd like to go see it as an artifact of history, if not an actual giant.
Yeah, I want to see the Coen Brothers movie about this.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, like the whole time you were talking about it, my brain was just, every shot was like a Coen Brothers shot.
And like those long traveling segments between Iowa and Montana, you know there's going to be some weird stuff that happens there.
Weird stuff in the train.
Goofy lackeys. Oh, yeah. Oh, beautiful. Oh, yeah.
All right, well, get on it. Pitch it to them.
I will. Yeah, next time I meet with them.
Yeah, you know, when you have lunch, whatever. Next link.
Next link.
Okay, from Live Science, a lost biblical tree has been resurrected from a 1,000-year-old mystery seed found in the Judean desert.
The true Jesus tree. It's been resurrected in Judea.
Nice.
I mean, you know, that metaphor is pretty apt. And now they're saying that the tree that has grown from it might even belong to a lost lineage mentioned in the Bible. Yeah, so it's taken researchers almost 14 years to grow a tree from the ancient seed, which archaeologists excavated from a cave in the late 1980s. They dubbed the seed Sheba, lovely name. And now this specimen stands around 10 feet tall, meaning scientists can finally describe its fully fledged characteristics. Here are some of the takeaways. The seed from which Sheba grew dates to between AD 993 and 1202. They're thinking it survived from a now extinct population of trees that existed in the southern Levant, which is a region comprising modern day Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. So good luck finding more seeds there, I guess. But it's the first of its kind to be found there. Now, what's remarkable is that researchers are saying that this fully grown specimen might be the source of biblical tsori, that's T-S-O-R-I, which is a resinous extract associated with healing. They mention it in Genesis, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel.
Huh.
What this actually referred to has been a wide historical subject of debate. But having revived Sheba, the team thinks it has finally unraveled the mystery. The reason is because they identified Sheba as belonging to the genus Commiphora, which sits within the myrrh and frankincense family.
Okay.
It comprises around 200 living plant species, and they're mainly found across Africa, Madagascar, and the Arabian Peninsula. So it's still unclear which species Sheba belongs to, mostly because the tree has yet to flower. And so we haven't been able to see any of the reproductive material scientists would need to carry out some additional analysis. So, geeking out into some of the particulars about Sheba's leaves and resin. The tree is rich in pentacyclic triterpenoids. These are biologically active compounds with anti-inflammatory and anti-cancer properties. The leaves and stems were also high in squalene, which is a natural oily substance with antioxidant and skin-smoothing properties.
I mean, so it sounds like when they brought baby Jesus gold, frankincense, and myrrh, they were basically bringing like diaper rash ointments. Like, this sounds like a skincare thing.
Honestly, if you look into properties of ancient incense, it's not just the fragrance. Even sage smudging in indigenous or Native American cultures, there are compounds within sage that when combusted can help with respiratory issues, which is so counterintuitive for smoke. So I don't know. I'm stoked.
So we need to protect this tree at all costs because the U.S. is definitely going to come try and collect it, is what I'm hearing.
Yes, tree security. I think all trees should have good security. Okay, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from Psy.News. It's titled, New Research Sheds Light on How Human Brain Processes the Number Zero.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, literally. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
So the number zero holds a special status among numbers indispensable for developing a comprehensive number theory. In new research, neuroscientists from the University Hospital Bonn, the University of Bonn, and the University of Tübingen conducted single neuron recordings in neurosurgical patients while they made judgments involving non-symbolic number representations and symbolic numbers. Neurons showed responsiveness to either the empty set or numeral zero, but not both.
Hmm.
So Professor Florian Moorman, a neuroscientist at the University Hospital Bonn, said, unlike other numbers such as 1, 2, or 3, which represent countable quantities, 0 means the absence of something countable, and at the same time still has a numerical value. In contrast to positive natural numbers, the concept of the number 0 only emerged late in human history over the last 2 millennia. This is also reflected in childhood development, as children are typically only able to understand the concept of 0 at around the age of 6. Dr. Esther Cutter said, we were able to measure the activity of individual nerve cells and actually found neurons that signaled 0. Such neurons responded to either the Arabic numeral 0 or the empty set, but not to both. So at the neuronal level, the concept of 0 is not encoded as a separate category nothing, but as a numerical value integrated with other countable numerical values at the lower end of the number line.
Wait, so it's like the dark matter or antimatter to low value numerals?
I think so, yeah. It's like it's part of the continuum, but it's still treated differently by the neurons in some way. So like it kind of lives in both worlds almost,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah.
So Professor Moorman added, despite this integration, the empty set is encoded differently from other numbers at the neuronal population level. This could explain why the recognition of the empty set also takes longer at the behavioral level than for other small numbers. For Arabic numerals, however, this effect was not found at either the neural or behavioral level. From this, we recognize the importance of symbolic representations for the integration of the number 0 on the number line in the human brain. So, if I'm understanding this correctly, basically the brain has a harder time with the abstract concept of 0 or nothingness or an empty set, but if it's in the context of like counting down 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, it's easier in some way, but there's like an overloading. Like there's almost two different meanings and understandings of the concept of 0 to the brain because it's different from a thing that you can actually count or treat as a number.
Right. Well, it's kind of like if you're looking at the number 2, you're not inherently thinking about two somethings. You're thinking about the number 2. But when you get to 0, you sort of inherently start thinking about the concept of nothing in addition to it being an actual number that you can manipulate.
Yeah.
And then you're overwhelmed with the vastness of nothing and you have an existential crisis, I'm sure.
Like an impending state as well as a value.
Right.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah. I'm wondering how it registers in Terrence Howard's brain.
I don't know who that is.
Yeah.
He's the actor. He has a new math where he says 1 times 1. Yeah.
So he's crazy. He's just like spouting about numbers.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Cool.
All right.
I'll look him up. Next link.
Next link.
Okay. This one was particularly interesting for me. The Guardian. Fussy eating in children, largely down to genetics, research shows. I am a very picky eater, and I always have been.
Hashtag born this way.
Right.
Yeah, parents who find themselves frustrated by their child's fussy eating take heart. Researchers investigated eating habits in toddlers to teenagers and found that on average, fussiness over food changes little from 16 months to 13 years old. There was a minor peak in pickiness at 7 years, then a slight decline thereafter. For some, not me. When they looked into the drivers of fussy eating, DNA emerged as the dominant factor. Genetics variation in the population explains 60% of the differences in pickiness at 16 months, rising to 74% for 3 to 13 years old.
Hmm.
So you're not a bad parent.
Mm-hmm.
They're bad children.
Oh, right. No!
Take them back. Get a refund.
But it is your fault genetically. Like, if these are your biological children, it's still your fault.
Oh, boy.
Dr. Zeynep Nas, a behavioral geneticist at UCLA, said, the main takeaway from this work is that food fussiness is not something that arises from parenting. It really does come down to genetic differences between us. But other factors that influence fussy eaters come down to the environment they live in. Sitting down to eat as a family and the kinds of foods consumed by the people around them will have an effect. Nass and her colleagues analyzed data from the UC Gemini study, which enrolled 2,400 sets of twins to explore how genetics and the environment affected childhood growth. To work out how much genetics contributes to fussy eating and how much of it is down to environmental factors, the research compared the eating habits of identical twins and non-identical twins.
Mm.
experiences that twins shared, such as the kinds of foods eaten at home, were important drivers of pickiness when they were toddlers. Between the ages of 7 and 13, individuals' experiences, such as having different friends, explained about 25% of the variation in fussy eating levels.
That's huge.
Yeah, which explains it, because I didn't have any friends. So that makes sense. While genetics is clearly important in fussy eating, it should not leave parents feeling disempowered. Genetics isn't destiny, but peers and friends might become a more important influence on children's diets as they reach their teens. So if I'm understanding that, peer pressure works.
Yes, it does. It gets a bad rap, but sometimes you want to pick a quality friend.
Kids will eat more things if they're worried about ridicule from their friends. Mm-hmm. I guess,
just right? Make sure it's not a Tide Pod.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include The Two Faces of Space-Time, The Journey of 10 Billion Birds, and The Wild West of Papal Conclaves. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.